Welcome to the show. Today, I'm super excited to have with us Dan Vega. Dan is a developer advocate, a Spring developer advocate at VMware Tanzu. He's also a YouTuber. He's a pretty prolific content creator, actually. I've been following Dan for a while. He makes some amazing YouTube videos. He writes tutorials for... I read some of his content on the Tanzu developer portal, on the Spring Source website. He also hosts the Spring Office Hours, which streams on the Spring Developer YouTube channel. So big fan for a long period of time and super excited to have him with me today. So hello, Dan. Welcome to the show.
Wow. Thank you for that awesome introduction. And I could say the same thing. I could literally turn around and say the same thing about you. I've been a big fan of yours forever. I mean, as long as I've been into Spring and Java, I've been watching your content. I feel like we have like similar styles of teaching. I think we have similar styles of learning, just as a faraway observation. So I think we teach a similar way because of the way that we like to learn. So yeah, I'm a big fan of yours, a big fan of everything you do. So I'm really excited to sit down and chat with you today.
Well, thank you so much. That means a lot coming from you. There are so many things I want to talk to you about. Especially like, you know, as I've been following your content, you know, I read some of your stuff and like, I wish I could ask you this. So now this is an opportunity. So, I'd like to kind of pick your brain on a few things.
Cool.
I want to start out with your journey of how you got to this. So you're a Spring developer advocate. You've been coding for a while. But, you know, can you tell me about like what got you into this industry in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
And from there to doing what you do now, which is being the voice of Spring in a way, and, making all this content and interacting with the community.
Yeah, so I'll kind of give you a high level. We won't go through the entire roadmap because that would probably take a long time. I have been doing this a long time, so 23 years or so. It was funny. I tell people this. When I was in high school, you know, computers weren't what they were today, right? Like I graduated in late 90s in high school. And my mom got me into a typing class when I was like a junior in high school. And I was just like, why are you putting me in this class? Like, I don't want to, like, I don't need these skills. This is not something I'm interested in. And it's just funny, like, that the things that you kind of fight your parents on turn out to be some of the most valuable skills, right? Like I really enjoyed that class. I learned how to type really well in that class, and that was a skill that like really, you know, helped my career along the way. I don't know. It's funny. I think I fell into this by chance, just because of my love for computers. It happened late in high school. I really like fell in love with like desktop computers, building your own computers. You know, back then we used to build them, you know, go to the store, buy all the parts, build them. And I really got fascinated with computers through that. And then the software that kind of ran on them. I really just loved the idea that like you could build these things that ran on a computer. Again, at the time it was a lot of desktop. The web was, you know, not as prevalent as it is today. And I don't know. I'd see all these movies like Hackers, and like I just really got into it. I fell into it by chance and just kind of like a curiosity. And you know, from there and like writing, you know, just getting into like HTML, CSS, JavaScript. I mean, it was just like it was an instant like I know this is what I want to do the rest of my life. Like I loved it. I love the creative aspect. I love the there is no person telling me this is the path that you have to take to produce this output, right? So I got into it and I just told myself, like, I don't understand any of this, but I'm going to do everything I need to do to make sure that I understand it. And so, yeah, it's never been easy for me. I've always felt like, and I think other people do this as well, I have always felt like I've had to study like 10 times harder than a lot of other people. Yeah, for whatever reason, it's just never like I never grasp things really quickly. So I study hard. I work really hard at learning things. And yeah, so from there, it just kind of took off. I got into a startup company in San Francisco. So I moved out to San Francisco for a couple of years, got into Java out there. I was a support engineer for that company. but they had a lot of their corporate website was written in struts at the time. So that's really kind of what got me into Java. And, you know, I had an associate's degree in Java at the time. So, so I got into that. And then just different jobs throughout my career kind of took me different places, whether it was building stuff for the web, being a senior engineer. I took a little detour to a coding boot camp where I helped write curriculum for both the instructors and the students. On the Java and Spring side, so that was really fun. Learned a lot there about, you know, creating content in general. I was a principal architect for a little while, and then some things opened up, and I got, you know, notified about a position at VMware about being a Spring Developer Advocate, and my eyes just like lit up. Like, this is my dream job. This is like, I've been a Spring Advocate before VMware. Like, I've been a big fan of Java and Spring. So when I found this out, it took a while to get in there, but my persistence paid off. And now I get to wake up and this is what I'm doing today, is talking to you. So like, I love my job.
sounds good, actually. How do you see this switch between, you know, you were working on things, you were building stuff, you were like hands-on execution to this role, which is probably, I'm sure it has some execution components as well, but it's a lot of the other side of things, like the soft skills, talking to people and all that.
Yeah, for sure.
What do you prefer and why? I'm guessing this balance is right for you because you like the job. Yeah. How do you see that transition?
Yeah, so I think, you know, when I was building software, and this isn't for every role that I've had, but I can certainly say this in some roles that I've had, it was very stressful. Like, this particular 2-week stretch of building software is the most important 2 weeks of your career, right? We have to get this feature out. And as much as I love building software, like, not everything is that important, right? Like, we're building software here. And so I love writing code, but I like writing code freely. I don't like the kind of, you know, the stress that gets put onto it in those types of scenarios. And I think there's a way that in a professional environment, and I've done it, where you can write code and still kind of enjoy it without all of that. So I told myself when I got into this developer advocacy role that a lot of things I hear from advocates is they don't write code anymore. And I said, I'm not going to do that. Like, I enjoy writing code. I need to keep writing code. Like, I don't want to lose that part of my job that I've enjoyed for 23 years. So I make it a focus that, you know, the things that I'm teaching, the things that I need to learn things every day. The way that I'm going to learn them is the way that I'm going to teach them. I'm going to read documentation. I'm going to read articles, watch other videos, and then I'm going to do. And so I reinforce everything that I learned by just hacking together projects on my own and putting together a list of things I want to build and making sure that I don't lose that. Because if I lose that, then I can't connect with the community that I'm out here to serve. So,
right. And that's super important. A lot of things that you shared there resonate with me, Dan, because I agree. A big draw for people to get into the software industry is that creative aspect to it. The ability to kind of make something, create something out of nothing.
Yeah.
And you don't have the high barrier to entry that's in a lot of other industries. Like, if you have a laptop, sure, you can build the next Facebook if you want. Yeah. The users aren't going to be there, but you can still build that thing. Mm-hmm. And hey, I also built my PC, so I can understand the appeal for that. There's actually a pretty vibrant PC building community.
Yes.
That's, you know, that goes along with the gaming community because that's like the biggest market.
But I couldn't do that today. It's a lot of fun. If you asked me to build a computer today, I'd be lost. There's just too many like moving parts.
I feel it's actually easier today than it was good 20 years ago, right? It's like, just here are four things, put them together exactly this way, and you're done.
Yeah, you do have YouTube now too, which you could watch.
You do have YouTube, yes.
Just follow a tutorial. So,
absolutely. All right. I want to ask you more about the developer advocacy role.
Yeah.
Because I'm curious myself, and I'm guessing there are some future developer advocates listening to this right now.
I sure hope so.
What does it mean to be a developer advocate? I have some rough idea, but I want to hear from you. Like, what are your job, what roles and responsibilities in your job?
Yeah, it's funny. If you ask 10 developer advocates what their role means to them, I'm guessing you might get 10 different answers. And developer advocacy means different things to different companies, right? Because it sits in different organizations in different companies. I heard a podcast with Lee Robinson probably a couple years ago, who's a developer relations manager at Vercel. And this has always kind of stuck with me. And his kind of philosophy is my philosophy too. And I think when it comes to DevRel, it really centers around three things: product, education, and community. So those are my three buckets that I really try to focus on. So product, I'm a Spring developer advocate. The Spring ecosystem is massive. It's not just Spring Framework. It's not just Spring Boot. There are a ton of projects in the Spring ecosystem. So when it comes to product, what challenges are developers facing? So when I'm talking to developers on social media or at a conference, like, what are you having trouble with? What is keeping you up at night? When I'm talking to customers, like, what are you moving towards? Hey, we're moving towards microservices, or we're moving towards Spring Boot 3. What can we help you with? So really, it's about the product, understanding what people are what challenges people are facing. Then it comes to education. Like, how are we going to educate the people that are having issues with certain products, right? I do this through a number of mediums. I like to write. I have a YouTube channel. We have the Tanzu Developer Center. We have this new product called Spring Academy, which is a really great resource to learn everything Spring. So I'm kind of involved in all of those things. And then community is really big for me. Like, I've always been big in community, whether it's locally here in the Cleveland area. You know, I work with the Java Cleveland user group. I help out there as much as I can. Speaking at conference, speaking at meetups, being active on social media, understanding that you have a platform and to use it for good. So part of that community is kind of comes back to product and gives it a full circle. Is when I'm in the community, what questions do people have? What can I help out with? Because this is my job. I get to go, oh, you're having issues with Spring Cloud Gateway and you don't understand it? Well, I don't either. Let me go learn it and kind of teach it back to you. So, yeah.
Okay. So you're basically being a bridge between the community and the core Spring Framework team. Like, I'm guessing part of your job is also like, you know, here is where the community is struggling. How can we kind of incorporate that into the framework and make it easier?
Yes.
Right?
So we're constantly talking to the Spring engineering team. So whether they need us to kind of amplify a message like, hey, there's this new feature. I don't think people know about it. Let's try and get that out there. Or vice versa. Hey, I'm working with GraphQL. I hear a lot of the community asking these types of questions. Can we incorporate that back into the product? So yeah, it is a two-way street there.
And when you're making content like this, I find it interesting because I do this for fun.
Yeah.
And it's your job. You're getting paid to do this, which is super appealing for me. The question that I have is, for me, like, when I'm putting out a YouTube video, it's purely driven by my passion for the topic. Like,
right.
I really like it, or I use the feature and I really like it and I do it.
Yeah.
How much of, like, when you put out content, how much of that is Dan Viga, the Spring expert, versus Dan Viga, the developer advocate? Like, do you have certain restrictions? Does the company say, okay, you should say this, here is the message, you have to be on point?
Right.
Like, how much of freedom and, you know, in expression do you have in this role?
Well, first off, I think I'm extremely lucky to have a manager that I have. My manager, Tasha, really gives me free rein and says, you are the content creator, you go out and do your thing and be involved in the community. And so you use the word Spring expert there. I don't see myself as a Spring expert. I've been doing this a while, but I don't see myself as an expert. I very much am connected to the community, and I think I have the same problems they do. So recently, Spring Boot 3.2, the milestones came out, and some new things came in that, like the JWC client and the REST client. And if I was not in this role and I was just a fan of like Spring, those are some things that I would want to hear about. Like, hey, tell me about these new features. I might want to be able to use those in my next application. So a lot of the times I'm just a Java developer who likes Spring and I want to see content on those things. So like you, when I got started at YouTube, I was very much in the game of like, what is going to get the most views? Who's going to get the most subscribers? And I've almost like dropped all of that. I just like make content that I would like to see because I represent the avatar that is watching my videos, right? Like I'm the same person. Like I want to see these cool new features. So I make videos that I want to make. And I also make videos driven by the community. Like, hey, you know, I've done a lot of GraphQL over the last couple of years because that is a product it's a new product that we had, but it's also something that a lot of people were really interested in. And when I started talking about it, I got more interest in it at different conferences. So if the community's asking for something, I'll create that. If people are having challenges around a particular product, I'll create that. If I have nothing else to do, I'm going to create whatever I find interesting because, again, I think, and the numbers have kind of backed that up for me, like what I find interesting, other people find interesting. Not all the time, but in general, so.
Yeah. I was looking at your YouTube channel, and I can see perhaps a period of time where you were kind of like playing the YouTube game,
yes.
You know, it's, yes. You know, the fancy thumbnails, the facial expressions. I've seen you do this.
I still have those.
I feel like there is some amount of like, it's the rules to play the game. Like
yes.
Everybody goes through that.
Yeah.
I have debated for the longest period of time to do those, you know, the crazy thumbnails and all
yeah.
that stuff. It's yeah. They,
so,
you know, yeah.
The thumbnails, all I really do like at the end of a video is I'll sit here and I'll just like take a couple pictures in a video format and then I can capture that out. And yeah, it's unfortunate, but like so on YouTube, really the title and the thumbnail is almost more important than the video to begin with, because as great as the content can be, if somebody doesn't click on it, they're never going to watch the video. So, and again, I know this may come across as like people are saying, well, you're lying. But to me, especially these days, like subscribers don't matter to me. I mean, views do because I want people to like consume the content and learn something from it. But views matter more than subscribers. And so I want people watching the videos. So I am playing the game a little. But I'm not playing the game as in I don't do a bunch of research into like a particular topic and figure out keywords and figure out like the greatest SEO title and description to like make this thing get, you know, attract subscribers. I just want to make content and hopefully people will find it. And then, you know, with some crazy face, maybe you'll click on the thumbnail. So, and, you know, part of the face thing, too, is once you get a few subscribers and people know you who you are, then you're really kind of giving a brand to that video. You're like, oh, here's a new video on the JWC client. Oh, I see it's Dan. I've seen a video of his before. I'll click on that. So that's part of my reasoning behind that as well.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. It's the first impression, the
yeah.
thumbnails is what gets a user in
yeah.
to watch the video, which is essential.
Yeah.
But then after that, I think it's the quality of the
for
content
sure.
that gets them going.
For
so,
sure.
And I guess
gonna,
as a part of...
They're going to do like AB thumbnail testing at some point later this year, which yeah. I'm excited about. Because if I could just go back to like, you know, writing some kind of software to generate these thumbnails for me, then that would be great. Like that,
yeah.
that's less time I got to spend on a video. So
yeah. But no, I think your content is really well put together. It's very professional.
I appreciate it.
Do you have a team or do you do that
on your
own? No,
just me. So when I started out, and funny story, the thing that if you go back on my YouTube channel, you'll find some from like 6 years ago when I was like, I was doing like some groovy videos. I think my first like video ever was like the Groovy Environment Manager, which is now SDK Man. I did a video on how to use that. Cause we did a lot of like Groovy and Grails back in the day. So I was big into that world, but the very first like course I put together was for Udemy. the reason I did it is because I looked on Udemy and I saw like these teachers who had like, you know, 500,000 students in a course. And I said, wow, at $199, they must be making like, they must be rich people. And, you know, then, you know, I was younger, didn't have as much money. That was a way to make some extra income. I thought, wow, I could probably like do this full time if I had 500,000 students. You know, come to find out Udemy is a coupon driven, nothing wrong with it, but I just didn't understand it at the time. That's what got me into it. I shot the like A-roll on an iPhone that didn't, you know, on an iPhone on a tripod. And I had to like run around and see if I was in frame and run back to the other side. And those courses are still on Udemy. You could find the original videos. They're terrible, but it's part of the process. You have to go through the, I don't know how to do anything to get to this point. I'm still not an expert, but I'm, my videos are much more polished than they were then. And you got to take your lumps. You got to learn how to like everything from video to audio to production, to recording your screen, you know, everything that goes in, there's a lot that goes into producing a simple 4 or 5 minute video. You have to learn that, and it takes reps. Most of the expert YouTubers out there will say, hey, if you want to get good at this, you got to make 100 videos. They're probably all going to be crappy, probably not going to get a lot of views, but try to get a little bit better in each one, try to fix something in each one, and that's how you learn, and that's how you get better at this. So.
Yeah, and that's true for anything. All of the popular creators today.
Right? Yeah.
Like you go look at some of their old content, and I still have my, like the video that I made 10 or 11 years ago that's still sitting there, and I occasionally stumble across it. Like somebody comments and says, the audio sucks, right? I don't know. They've probably seen my newer video, and then they somehow YouTube recommends it, whatever. I take a look at that and I cringe, but I'm not going to remove it because it's like it's a reminder,
right? It is,
a reminder that it's a journey.
It's a part of the it's a process. I mean, just as developers, what if we went back and looked at our code from 20 years ago?
Exactly.
I would be like, whoa, I remember building tables in Front Page 20 years ago. So yeah, that was pretty awful.
All right. One other thing I want to ask you, and then we can switch over to Spring. I was looking at the stuff that you've created. I see like Java, Spring Boot, Vue.
Yep.
Like it's a bit of an outlier. Like what got you interested in Vue and in front end?
I love building for the web, and this is what I started out in. I started building like HTML, CSS, JavaScript when you couldn't even really write JavaScript. You had to use like, you know, I was using like Macromedia Dreamweaver to like generate this weird JavaScript.
Fun stuff.
So I've always loved building for the web because there's something very tangible about it, and very like I could build something and it is live on the web right now. People are looking at it. I can send this to my wife, to my mom. They don't know what a back-end API is. They can't see that. It's not very tangible. But my website, they can see. So I have a website. I enjoy working on it. It's not the greatest looking thing in the world, but I take some pride in like over the years. Again, I've never been really good at things, so it's like takes me a little bit longer, but I really spend a lot of time trying to learn everything that goes into kind of building for the web. So I've been a fan of JavaScript for a while, and then when I got into the coding bootcamp, we had to teach some kind of front end component architecture, right? And it was down to like, okay, there's Vue, there's Angular, and there's React. And the decision wasn't made by me, but it was made collectively, and I kind of agree with this decision. Well, React is the most popular, but you just taught students JavaScript and HTML. They're going to get very confused by this React syntax where you're kind of mixing the two, right? It's a lot to take in, even for someone who's been doing this for a while. Angular is great, but then you have to also learn TypeScript. You're required to learn TypeScript. Yeah. You just learned JavaScript. We don't have time to get into that. Vue made the most sense because it's a single file component. All my HTML, my CSS, and my JavaScript is in one file, and it seems pretty easy to get going with. So that's why we got started with it. And I fell in love with it because it was because of that syntax, because it was so easy to do things that were complicated in other frameworks. I just want to update the DOM and I just want to like make this list of tables, you know, all the things that you want to do on the client side, Vue made it very easy for me. And so, yeah, so I've just been down that rabbit hole. I've spoken at a couple of Vue conferences, which has been really exciting for me. I'm involved in the Vue community. I'm actually speaking next month at Connect Tech in Atlanta on Nuxt. So Nuxt is a framework on top of Vue. And I'm a big fan of Nuxt, and my website's written in Vue. So yeah, I'm a huge fan of Vue, and I love being involved in that community as well.
I should check out. For the longest time, I've been thinking about Vue. I've programmed in Angular and React both, and I totally get you. Both of them have their quirks. Right?
Yeah.
TypeScript with Angular, I feel, is a little more complicated than it should be.
Right.
And JSX, I still haven't managed to get my head around how it works.
Yep.
So,
Yeah, Vue's great, and it's got a great community. And like I said, there are frameworks like Nuxt that make building entire applications really easy. So I've been doing a lot with Nuxt and Spring lately, so that's been fun.
Nice. All right, let's talk about Spring. I'm going to put you on the spot now.
All right.
Let's say you're in an elevator with the CEO of a top company whose tech stack is .NET, right? And you have to give an elevator pitch to that person about Spring and why they should consider Spring instead. I know you say it depends and all that stuff, but in this hypothetical scenario, you're convinced that they should go with Spring.
Right.
What would be a good elevator pitch for Spring or the Spring Boot or the whole ecosystem for somebody who has no idea what Spring is?
Yeah, so first I would say, Java as a programming language has been around 28 years now. So Java is a programming language that is used by enterprises all over the world. If you're looking for developers, you're going to be able to find developers. And Spring is the most widely used framework in the Java ecosystem, bar none. Spring Boot makes it really easy to get started with Spring. And you can build anything from a CLI application to an enterprise-grade system. So I think the use cases for Spring are wide. You can use it for a variety of different applications. And again, I think, standing on top of the shoulders of giants, which is Java, I think it's a great combination to build your next application in.
It's easy to sell Spring. it's kind of like the isn't it like 70% market adoption or something crazy like that?
Yeah, I don't know what the numbers are because it is high, but I always take those kind of results with a little bit of a grain of salt because I don't know who's asking those questions. So, different surveys or polls will show different numbers. But I know that, if you poll Java developers, what frameworks are they using? Spring is going to be at the top of pretty much all of those lists. And yeah, that makes that I'm proud of that. And I knew that before I got into this. Like I said, I've been a Spring advocate long before VMware was paying me to do so.
Right. Oh, one other thing that has it going for Spring is that it's kind of like the sheer diversity of the ecosystem, the kind of things that you can do with it.
Yep.
It's almost like here are the top 20 things that a Java developer would want to do in an enterprise application.
Right.
And here are 20 adapters for those things. You just put this thing in here and it's going to work.
Yeah.
That makes it like a no-brainer for a lot of these things. I don't think there's even a competition like which can do it at this scale, right? It's just Spring and nothing else.
Well, it's hard to. We're celebrating 20 years of Spring this year. We're celebrating 10 years of Spring Boot. So it's hard to kind of keep up with what Spring is doing because we've been doing it so long, right? 20 years, we've learned a lot about developing enterprise applications, just developing applications in general for the Java platform. And throughout those years, we've taken what we've learned and we've improved upon it. So one thing that I can say is that Spring has never stayed stagnant. It is always learning from the community. It's always learning from the Java community as a whole. What is Java doing and staying current with Java? So it's going to be hard to keep up. We've been doing this for 20 years, and I think doing a really good job of it.
How do you find it as a as a learning experience, though, because as great as it is, and as you know, wide in scope as it is, I'd imagine it's pretty daunting for somebody who's getting started.
Yeah.
Right? So they learn Java, they learn Spring. Okay, I know how to make a Spring MVC API in Spring Boot. I've got a REST API, and now what? And there is this explosion of things that they can go to,
for
right?
Sure.
That's how do you think somebody should handle that?
Yeah,
that kind of a challenge.
I get this question a lot. Like, hey, I want to learn Spring. Where do I start? And it's like, well, that's an overloaded question. Like, I think we need to step back and figure out what you're trying to learn, right? If you go into this saying I want to learn Spring, you're going to be overwhelmed. You are going to like get to the point where like I don't know if I want to do this anymore because it's too much. I get to do this every single day and learn and teach back. And I'm still overwhelmed. There are still so many things that I feel like I need to learn. So I think the way that you need to approach it is I want to learn Spring to do this. So as you said, we can build so many different types of applications using Spring. But if you narrow that result down and you say, I want to use Spring to build a REST API that talks to a database. All right, now we have a lane that we're in, right? So let's break that down. I want to use Spring to build a web API. Okay, we're going to build either a REST API or a GraphQL API. If you're building a REST API, great. Now we've kind of narrowed that down. We could build that out first. Now I want to talk to a database. How do you do that in Spring? Well, great. We have things like Spring Data JPA, Spring Data JDBC. It's really easy to talk to a database in Spring because of the abstractions. Not as easy to do in something just like pure Java, right? So we've kind of taken a path. Now throughout that path, maybe you might start to have questions like, okay, I need a property that can be externalized because I want to store this in a property file somewhere and change it at production time. Okay, that's something that we can learn now. Or, you know, I've built out this REST API. I don't understand how like dependency injection works and how Spring is handling that. Okay, now we can start to talk about that. So there are things that you'll learn along your path, but I think if you can come into it with, I have this project I'm working on at school, I have this thing to do at work, I have this thing I want to learn, and narrow that path down, that'll make it a lot less overwhelming and at least give you a guide to kind of get to the end goal there.
I feel like there up to a certain point, the path is narrow and people generally don't have a problem with it. I would say up to building an API, right?
Yeah.
Or perhaps even talking to a relational database because that's like the, you know, no matter what database you use, you learn to talk to a relational database.
Yep.
But after that point, once they have built an API and it's connecting to an RDBMS using JPA, returning a response, and they have the ability to create one service, from there on, things become a little bit blurry.
Yeah.
How would, like, you know, if you were to, so what you were talking about was like an exchange, right? You ask them what are their use cases,
yes.
And then you say, okay, if you do this, you need to pick this up.
Mm-hmm.
How do you replicate that exchange, or perhaps make an online so that it's self-serve?
Mm-hmm.
Like somebody has those answers. Is there a way they can go online and say, okay, here are my use cases. What is it that I need to learn? And then something tells you this is what you need to learn.
Yeah, so I think there's a few ways to do this, at least on the Spring side. So I'm a big fan of documentation. If there's good documentation on a project, then I'm more inclined to go through it. So I think the Spring team has done a really good job of putting together documentation over the years, and even more so of late, made it much easier to kind of jump between versions, search for things. So I think starting at the documentation is a good point. We also have guides on both the Spring.io website and the Tanzu Developer Center that you mentioned. And I think the guides are a good way to do that. Like, hey, I don't need to know everything. I just need to know how to enable scheduling in my application, right? Like, that is the one thing I'm doing right now. How do I enable the scheduler to work, right? So there's a guide on how to do that. There's guides on how to do, like, a bunch of things like that. So I think going through that process, looking through the docs, looking through the guides, and understanding what it is you're trying to accomplish, now you can go off and, after you do that, kind of do your self-searching. Like, I'm going to search YouTube for a video on how dependency injection works in spring, right? And try to deep dive on that. So I think it's a combination of using the resources that are there and then kind of reflecting on that and understanding it enough to do some self-searching on it.
I feel like there might still be some unknowns, and maybe there is an opportunity here. This is what I've, you know, I've thought about this a while.
Yeah.
So, for example, go to start.spring.io, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have all the starters that you can add.
Yep.
And, you know, it's like you need to know the name of the starter, and then you kind of add it to it.
Mm-hmm.
What we need is the opposite, right? It's like you're trying to, you start with the use case.
Yep.
And you're searching for the use case, and then it, you know, you land on a starter.
Yeah.
I think that's a little trickier.
It is. Yeah. And yeah. And like you said, to start this off with, I mean, we can use Spring for so many use cases, and that's where it gets a little complicated, because we have a solution for everything. So we need to know the problem first.
Right. What I find really, you know, amazing is, you know, sometimes in the office hours, there's some question about some obscure feature of some small component which I wouldn't have even heard about.
Yeah.
And they're like, how does this work?
Right.
And you're like, you know, okay, this seems to be something. Let's go look it up. I mean, there's no way any human being can know everything involved. But still, any small use case there is, any small feature of the framework, there's somebody using it, and kind of like their application depends on it.
Yeah,
it's a nice feeling that it's like, you know, even though it's so complex,
yep,
it's still being used in some sense.
Yeah, for sure.
You talked about 11 years of Spring Boot. I'm thinking back to the first announcement of Spring Boot being 10 years. Sorry.
Yep.
Yeah. I remember the first announcement of Spring Boot being this thing, mm-hmm. which is, you know, there are so many ways you can configure Spring, but if you want the default opinionated way,
yep.
you use this.
Yeah.
And if you don't like the opinionated way, you don't have to use it, right? That was the message that Spring Boot kind of launched with.
Yeah.
Today, 10 years since, it's pretty much the only way, and like the opinions that were optional at the time are like the way to do things. Do you think that it's basically us realizing that one way is good enough, and that's the reason why we've kind of let go of all the other things? Or do you feel like there's still an opportunity for, or a need for, a non-Spring Boot, okay, I don't like how this works, I'm going to tweak it just like it was 10 years ago?
Yeah, so I think the idea of convention over configuration has been around for a long time, right? And it's the idea that, yeah, I could fully configure this application, but that's going to take me a long time. I need some conventions to get me up and running out of the box quickly. And I think Spring Boot has always done that well. I will kind of do a little pushback on you there and say that, like, yeah, there is a convention to getting started. But if there's anything that you want to change at any point, there's a way to change it. So I'll just give an example. If you create a new app and you say, hey, this is going to be a website, this is going to be a web app that's going to talk to a database. You know, we're going to do some things behind the scenes with auto configuration. We're going to create a new data source bean so that you don't have to. If you want to override that, you have full power to do so. If you want to like tweak how that setting is going to happen, how that configuration is going to get set up, you can. But for 80, 90% of us just kind of starting up an application that talks to a database, those defaults are great. They're going to get me up and running. So I think that is good. It's allowing us to focus on the business case at hand and not the infrastructure of getting this application up and running.
The other question I wanted to ask you was regarding the new things that have come up in Spring Boot. Well, not technically new, it's been around for a year. The AOT stuff,
yep.
Graal VM. I was listening to some of the Spring One talks, which
yes.
happened recently.
Yep.
Folks who are listening to this episode, if you haven't watched that, you should check it out. There's a lot of cool stuff there. There's a lot of new stuff happening, right? So one is the golden paths, golden developer paths that was constantly brought about. The cloud adoption, AOT, scale to zero.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see this being adopted by the Java community at large? Are they still learning it, or are they all in and they're starting to use it? How is it in terms of the adoption scale?
Yeah, so at least for the AOT, we'll start with kind of the AOT story, which was one of the major themes in Spring Boot 3, which was the AOT transformations. So Java as a whole is a pretty dynamic language. You don't hear Java and think that because Java is a statically typed language. But Java has a lot of dynamic capabilities, right? At runtime, we can do things like reflection and proxies and grab resources from wherever we need to. So there's a lot of dynamic capabilities in Java. But if we want to get to like an AOT, so AOT is ahead of time compilation. This is a prerequisite for something called GraalVM. And GraalVM allows us to create a native executable. So why would you want to create a native executable? Well, it ends up using a lot less memory, and it ends up starting up significantly faster because you don't have to warm up an execution environment that includes something like the JVM and then, you know, everything else that goes into that. So the AOT is really in response to the types of applications customers were building. And so AOT may not be a let's move every application we have to a native executable, right? It turns out that the JVM is really good at optimizing in certain situations. One of those situations is I have an application that is long running, that is taking requests, thousands, millions of requests, and always up and running. In that case, the JVM does really good at figuring out certain things underneath the hood and optimizing for it, right? So in that scenario, I would not move to, say, a native executable. Although there have been announcements from GraalVM lately that their kind of JDK that they're working on, they've seen improvements in the JIT compared to the native executable. So, but we'll see where that ends up. But there are certain workloads where this is not the case, right? Think of the traditional example is a serverless function. So if I write a serverless function, this is going to sit on something like AWS Lambda, and maybe it is just going to come up, take a request. I use like my newsletter as an example. I don't get a lot of newsletter subscribers, but when I send a request out, this environment has to come up, process that request, and then shut down. And it does this 10 times a day. Why would I want that short-lived process to run the entire day when it's only going to take a few requests? I don't. But the problem is, in a traditional Java JVM environment, there is this thing called cold start because it's just got to start up. It's got to warm up that execution environment, get a JVM ready, and then, you know, respond to that request. In that scenario, I don't want that. So a native executable now takes everything, puts it into a binary that can be run on whatever environment you're in, uses way less memory, uses way less startup time. So in that scenario, or in a scenario of scale to zero where I have a bunch of applications that I don't need running all the time, this makes perfect sense. So this is, again, I think just the Java community, the Spring community, listening to its customers, listening to what people are trying to build, and giving them a solution to that.
I've heard some, one of the few criticisms of Spring has always been it takes a while to start because it's kind of starting up all the beans. So it kind of directly addresses that head on.
Yeah.
Do you have a sense for how it works? Because the normal way this works is you have all these proxy beans that get created. Mm-hmm. And when the dependency injection happens, it kind of like gets the actual bean through the proxy.
Yep.
Does AOT actually flatten it and not use proxy at all? Like the dependent and the depender are hardwired?
Yeah. So I think let's take Spring out of it for a second and step back just to Java. I did a video on my channel on how this works. So if you want to create something for GraalVM, I created just a very simple class that uses reflection. Now reflection is not going to play because what happens is we want to take all of those dynamic capabilities and have a closed world assumption of what's going to happen at runtime. So what we do is we can't do that reflection at runtime. So what we do is we provide hints to the GraalVM compiler to say, hey, class A and class B that I would normally use Reflection to load, we're not going to use Reflection. You know about them now because I'm telling you where they are, what they are, when they're going to get called. So now that the GraalVM compiler has all these hints as to where things are, it now can make assumptions of every path it's going to take at runtime. So it knows that. So because of that, when we compile down to native, now it knows how to do that without, you know, a JVM environment there. So the way that Spring does that is to make this happen. The Spring team, every other project in the Spring ecosystem, had to go through and provide hints for all of the dynamic capabilities that happen in Spring. So it says, hey, you're going to use a JPA repository at runtime. No, you're not. I know where that is. Here's a hint. You're going to use this. And so, yeah, this is why this was such an undertaking for the Spring, probably the biggest undertaking they've ever taken on, which was being able to make sure that all of these projects were compatible with something like GraalVM. And so, yeah, providing those hints. And again, if you go back and watch that video, it was a lot for me to just do that one like little simple Reflection case. I can't even imagine what the team went through to kind of make this work.
Wow. Okay. that sounds pretty big.
Yeah, and there are projects in the ecosystem, right? Like all the popular projects that we use in everyday Java projects. And those have to contribute to these hints as well. And the Spring team in general has been one of the most contributed to that project more than any other team out there. So we've done an awesome job of giving back to the community as well. So if you build a Java project with something else, chances are we've probably contributed something to that.
Yeah. It's almost like you're changing almost one of the foundational design principles of Spring. I mean, like the whole proxying and this redirection has been since 1.0, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's one of the foundational things. You kind of have to strip that out and change it to something else.
Yeah, but again, for a certain use case, right? It's maybe not going to be for every use case, but for a certain use case, it's important.
Is this hardwiring the reason why you need a separate build per environment? Because right now, like if you do it using proxying, you can build an app, and then you can have different perhaps JPA adapters for different databases. Like, okay, you're in the QA environment, go, you know, this thing gets attached. If you're part, this other thing gets attached. Since we are connecting those, we need to now build a separate build for QA, a separate build for prod, and we cannot differ portion of it. It's an all or nothing thing, right?
So I think that's a little bit different. So the thing with AOT is there is a trade-off. The trade-off here is we need to provide these hints, right? And the build process to build an actual native executable takes a lot longer. But the problem with that, I don't know that we're doing that in our inner loop environment all the time. On my local machine, I'm not building native executables. Maybe I'm not building that, even that for, you know, say a prod or a test environment or a QA environment. And a lot of that may happen in kind of the CI/CD pipeline, right? So I think there are ways that that you can still kind of use all of Spring's goodness and the ability to configure things in different environments without having to kind of worry about what the end result is, a binary that's going to run in production somewhere, right?
The recommendation is not to use AOT for the test environments and only for one build for the prod?
No, I don't think so, but I think I'm less worried about it locally, right? Like I don't have to worry about the extra build step that it's going to take. So in an example, if I just wrote like a Hello World application in Spring and I build a native executable for that, that could take a couple minutes. But I'm not doing that every single time. Like I'm testing in my local environment with just the normal kind of Spring capabilities. But once I get to like test or production, yeah, my CI/CD pipeline somewhere is worried about that build and pushing that in. And then yeah, you're still able to like use Spring's configuration and say, hey, when you build this, this is for test environment. use this test property source. This is where all of that configuration is located.
Yeah, yeah, no, I see what you're saying. And honestly, all the build time concerns are, I think, you know, it's being overstated. I don't see the problem with, you know, the build being 2 minutes longer,
right?
Because you're generating. I mean, it's more of an offline thing. I get it if it's affecting your, you know, inner loop during development,
for sure.
Which nobody's going to use AOT for that,
right?
But for sticking it for a QA build, I don't see that as a problem,
right?
And you do want to do it. You don't want to have a non-AOT build for QA and an AOT build for prod, because
right.
you know that's going to place a lot of trust.
Yes.
That it is going to replicate exactly the same way.
The whole point
way.
Of QA and test is like, hey, we want to make sure that what
exactly.
we're going to put into production works, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. One other thing that came up in the SpringOne talks was the whole debate between reactive programming and virtual threads.
Yeah.
That's a common question that I get asked as well.
Right? Yep.
Now that we're having virtual threads, is reactive programming dead?
Mm-hmm.
Is reactive Spring dead?
Yep.
My answer has always been, well, you can do, first of all, virtual threads aren't here. They're going to be, you know, stable and ready to go at some point. Well, I guess you can
yesterday.
Use it
yeah.
now. Yeah. Yesterday. Okay. Yeah. I still have to catch up. But I feel like reactive programming is a different way of coding. It's more of like a different pattern.
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree? What do you think is the point of decision that you need to make between those
yeah.
two?
So as we're recording this, Java 21 just came out yesterday, and virtual threads is now in JDK 21. And, you know, I get this a lot from Spring developers as we start, you know, I've been on the road talking about virtual threads and what it means to Spring developers. And virtual threads, so for me, when we get into like building these applications that are kind of in that thread per request model, right? We've all kind of run into these applications where we build them, everything works great, we push it to production, now it gets all this traffic, and oh, now things are running slow or things are not performing as they need to. So we take a look at ways to scale our applications, right? So we have a couple different ways that we can scale them. We can scale them through hardware, we can scale them through reactive programming. Hardware, we can throw more, you know, in a vertical sense, more memory and CPU at it, or we can throw more servers at it. Asynchronous programming or reactive programming offers us a different scalability solution. We can say, hey, we're going to utilize the resources that we have much more efficiently. And so there are pros and cons to that approach, right? Like, it's an all or nothing thing. It isn't like, let me just mix in some reactive programming. It can be hard to learn at first. It's a paradigm shift, right? It can be harder to debug or profile. But at the end of the day, if you want to use it as a scalability mechanism, it is a great solution. It is going to give you everything that you're basically up against right now, right? It's going to give you a solution to those scaling issues. So that's kind of been where we are up until now. And then, you know, the idea of virtual threads came out, and virtual threads are no longer tied to a platform thread. So we're not using the resources. We're not kind of, especially in our traditional MVC apps that are talking to a database or talking to another service, we're not kind of tying up those resources. But what does that mean? So that means that, you know, in Spring going forward, Spring in the next version of Spring Boot, which will be out in November, release candidate in October, we'll have a simple switch in there that says, hey, use virtual threads. So if you're in an MVC application and you're traditionally like IO heavy, blocking heavy, talking to a service, talking to a database, this is going to give you significant scalability benefits. Like, you're going to get a lot more performance out of those applications that you have. And the best part about it is you don't have to change any of your code. You're just going to say, hey, use virtual threads instead of normal platform threads, right? So yeah, so now the question comes up, and I've heard this, you know, over and over again. It's like, well, what does this mean for reactivity? So reactive web apps. And as you said, you know, reactive programming is a different paradigm. And I think traditionally, if all you reached for reactive programming for was a way to scale your applications, okay, now you have another option here, which is virtual threads and using something like Spring MVC. The problem is that that is not everything that reactive programming solves. So a lot of the times we're using reactive programming in streams-based architecture. We're dealing with large data sets. We're dealing with back pressure. Something else reactive programming, in particular Spring Webflux, does really well is breaking up a task into multiple tasks and then kind of pulling those back together. So there is part of Project Loom and what came out yesterday in JDK 21. There are two other preview features. One is scope values. One is structured concurrency. Those are not in JDK 21 yet. And structured concurrency is a big one. Like, hey, I have this task. I want to separate it into three different tasks and, you know, aggregate that task back together at the end. That is not in the JDK yet. And that is something, you know, Webflux does really well. And it is a paradigm shift. And like you said, some people may prefer the reactive programming style. Some people may look at it and go, I don't understand that. I don't want to learn that. And I completely understand that. So my answer to everyone is that there is still a need for reactive programming in the Spring world. There's still a need for something like Spring Webflux. If all you reach toward for, though, is a scalability solution, you have another option now building Spring MVC apps in an imperative style.
Don't you think that that was the primary appeal and the primary kind of like claim to fame for reactive? Don't you think that most people did reach out to reactive for the scalability thing? It's not like there's a learning curve involved,
yes,
right?
Yes.
And it almost seemed like people were willing to pay the cost of, yes, the learning curve in order to get the scalability and not, you know, the pattern itself wasn't an appeal.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, I think that could be a large portion of what somebody would reach for reactive programming for. But I know there is a certain percentage that, you know, have to deal with large data sets and want to deal with like back pressure and, again, maybe use structured concurrency in certain places. So, yeah, it could be a large portion. But, you know, throughout that process of, hey, I didn't want to learn this thing, maybe they learned that thing and maybe it's something they actually really enjoy now. So, there are probably a few things throughout my career that I didn't want to learn that I ended up learning. And I go, wow, that's become really valuable.
Yeah, it allows you to do a few things that you wouldn't normally do. The programming paradigm, like just the functional programming paradigm,
yeah,
allows you to write,
yep,
I think allows you to write better code, like pure functions that you can, debugging is a little hard,
yeah,
but at least the pattern, you know, makes sure that you're not, you know, writing bad code.
It's very readable too. Like when I look at kind of reactive code, it has this like fluent API to it. I'm like, I understand, yeah, everything that's going on here. Whereas imperative, you're just like top down trying to go through everything.
I would say it depends on who is writing it.
That's true.
I've also seen code where
with all code,
there's a map and then there's this huge function. It's like, it's doing so much stuff. It's,
right.
So it really, as with any code, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. The other question was about the release cadence itself, right? You know,
yep,
we just started, like, I didn't realize that the new version came out yesterday. I need to catch up on
Java did, not Spring. Sorry.
Java and virtual threads. It's a challenge,
yeah,
to catch up.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to ask you, it's a two-part question. First of all, how do you do it,
mm-hmm,
right? It's but something that you have to stay on top of all the time. And secondly, how do you see the community doing it? Because Java has, for the longest period of time, been very conservative in adapting to new features. Like,
yep,
you know, I'm sure there is a huge population that's still on Java 8.
Mm-hmm.
So what is your read on the community? How quickly are they adopting it? How excited are they to jump on these new features?
Yeah, I think Java as a whole, you know, ever since Java moved to that kind of every 6 month release cadence, has really kind of energized the Java community. And, you know, Spring has been right along for that ride, trying to kind of stay paced with Java. And so I think that not that one big bang of every 4 years was not the greatest thing in the world, because it was hard. While it may seem like it was easier to adopt from I only have to learn this one release, it was also like so much to throw at somebody. So now every 6 months you get a few new features. It's much more manageable to kind of go through the release notes and understand what was added. And so for me, even for me as someone who gets to do this every day, I get overwhelmed. So with there's just so many things in programming and in business and in YouTube of things that I would love to learn, but I just don't have the time to do it. So I have to prioritize things. What are important to me? What things should I be learning? And really these days it's, you know, everything Java and everything Spring that the community is, you know, asking for, having challenges with. So the Spring Boot follows a similar cadence. There's a new release every 6 months. So we just released 3.0 in November of last year. So yeah, right around Thanksgiving. 3.1 came in May, and 3.2 will come in November of this year. So 3.0 was a big release, kind of groundbreaking a little bit, you know, a whole bunch of major themes there. But these dot releases that we've had lately have been like really exciting. So 3.1 came and we added something called the Docker Compose module, which will allow you to say from the Spring Boot initializer, say, I'm going to create a MVC app that talks to a Postgres database and I want to use this Docker Compose module. What it will do is it'll write a Compose YAML file for you. And when you start your Spring Boot application, it will start the Docker container for you and take those properties from the Compose file and inject them into a property source so you don't have to duplicate those properties across files. 3.2 is adding virtual threads and the JDBC client and the REST client. So these dot releases have been really exciting for developers. I think Java as an ecosystem is moving fast. Spring is moving right along with it. And yeah, we're helping customers. We are talking to customers that traditionally, as you said, a lot of, you know, enterprises are stuck on Java 8. And we're hoping to help that forward because we want everybody to be taking advantage of things like Java 17. So Spring Boot 3 is baselined on Java 17. And we're helping customers get there because just moving from 8 to 17 and forget about anything new. Just talking about performance and security improvements that you're going to get just out of that JDK upgrade, right? We want customers to move there. We want to, as a framework, we want to stay right along with it. So, it's exciting. It's exciting that Java and Spring are constantly evolving, and that means more things for me to learn and more things for me to teach. So keeps me on my toes for sure.
Yeah, it's it's like, you know, you have two conflicting desires here. I feel I empathize with the companies and teams who are stuck with an older version of Java because, you know, there's of course this appeal of all the new features, mm-hmm. the seductive performance improvements, the security, like new ways of writing code and all that. And then they go look at the ground reality of this, you know, 5 year, 10 year old code base, you know, hundreds and thousands of classes and, you know, XML files and all that.
Yep.
And having to upgrade that is a challenge, and it's always a cost. It's not, you know, for companies who aren't tech first and tech is just a means to an end, mm-hmm. It can be a challenge. So some of the things that I've been reading about is, some of the automated migration options, right? Like there's Open Rewrite, which is kind of pioneering in that space. How do you see that as a possible solution for this high release cadence? And again, do you see the community adopting it?
Yeah.
Would you recommend that as a way forward for these large code bases?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, specifically, we talk to customers that are on something like Spring Boot 2.4 and Java 8. How can we get to Spring Boot 3 and Java 17, right? So we go through and we talk like, hey, you can't just look at it as an organizational wide, let's just move everything, right? Pick an application. Let's pick this one app and let's see if we can't upgrade that. Instead of the big bang approach, how can we get from 2.4 to 2.7, which supports Java 17? So now we can just upgrade to Java 17, upgrade to 2.7. Once everything's working there, now we can just make the jump from 2.7 to 3.0. So once we can make that upgrade, now we can step back and go, yes, what are the tools that are going to help us do that? So one of the things in Spring Boot 3 is we've migrated from Java EE to Jakarta EE. So there's that namespace package that you got to change everywhere from Java X to Jakarta. You could go through and do a find and replace, but that is probably not the best idea because there are certain situations where, like Java X, you don't want to replace that, like Java X.SQL, right? Like you can't just do a find and replace. So there are tools that will help you out. This is integrated into like IntelliJ can do this pretty good. And then there are tools like Open Rewrite. So Open Rewrite has these things called recipes. And I have a recipe to migrate Java EE to Jakarta EE. So you run this recipe on your code base and it will go through and do all of the things that it needs to do. So there are all these different recipes, one for Spring, one for like Spring Security, one for Java, moving from Java 8 or 11 to 17. So we put all these recipes together and we go, okay, let's automate this process. So we automate the process of moving, upgrading to Spring Boot 3. That probably gets us 80% of the way there. So we get 80% of the way there. What's the other 20%? The other 20% is usually some in-house library that they wrote that maybe doesn't support Java 17 or some third-party dependency that they're using that maybe doesn't support whatever JDK they're trying to move to. So for those, are there certain situations where we can step back and go, maybe we can just rewrite that in-house library. Maybe we can find an alternative solution to that third-party library. Or maybe there's something going on where we can write our own recipe in Open Rewrite to automate that last 20%. And so I think, you know, taking one application, figuring out that path, taking advantage of the tools, so Open Rewrite, there is a project out there called Spring Boot Migrator too, which sits on top of Open Rewrite and adds some kind of functionality to that. So yeah, being able to take advantage of those tools to automate it so that, hey, I've gotten one application upgraded. Now let's see if we can automate some other ones. Because yeah, if you sit here and try to manually upgrade all these applications, it's going to be a painful process and it's going to cost a lot of money. And on the idea of costing a lot of money too, I will also say, yeah, it's not easy. In certain situations, it may cost your organization a lot of money to move to another version of JDK or Spring or whatever project you're on. But I think it's going to cost a lot more in the long run if you just keep kicking the can down the road, right? As I said, the industry as a whole was stuck on JDK 8 forever because that was the last Big Bang release. And then they didn't want to be able to have to like stay up on current versions. And I don't think you need to like automatically migrate to the newest JDK and the newest like Spring Boot 3.2 as soon as it comes out. But you have to have a plan. And I think going through this upgrade process, now you can come up with a plan and say, hey, when the new LTS of JDK comes out, we want to be on that in 6 months or a year, right? Not having a plan, if you fail to prepare, if you fail to plan on failing, right?
You have a plan to fail, yeah, right. Yeah.
So we have to have a plan in place. And I think these tools are going to definitely help us out.
Do you think it's a good idea to upgrade both Java and the framework like Spring at the same time? Or do you see them as two separate things? Just get to the LTS first, then get the Spring that's the baseline at that LTS.
Yeah, I think, like I said, if you were a customer and you came to me and wanted to upgrade and you're on 2.4, I would say try to get your application running on JDK 17 first, because that's a baseline for what we're trying to get to, right? So if you can get your applications running on 2.7, great. Now we can upgrade the Spring version to 2.7. Then we can check everything. Then we can move it to 3.0, and now we're in a happy place. So, yeah, I think going from the ground floor up is always a good idea.
Okay, makes sense. Here's another controversial question for you. And again, this is something that I get asked a lot. Spring Cloud versus Kubernetes. Uh-huh. How would I choose? Should I go with like a native Kubernetes solution, or should I use some of the Spring Cloud frameworks? There's a lot of overlap there, and I've often been asked, like, I get asked, is Java dead all the time? I get asked, is Spring Cloud dead now because Kubernetes is taking, or are there portions of Spring Cloud that are dead? I'm sure you get asked that too. What would be your answer for somebody like that?
So I think they're two distinct things. So Spring Cloud is a set of projects that enable us to build applications for the cloud. Now, there may be some overlap in there with things like a gateway. Maybe use gateway in a Kubernetes environment. That's fine. There's overlap there. But I don't think it's a you have to pick one or the other. So I'd be interested to if you were asking me that question, I would probably fire some questions back at you, like, why are you choosing between the two? And I think that a lot of the Spring Cloud projects allow us to build applications for the cloud, no matter where you're kind of deploying these to. And at the end of the day, if Kubernetes is your target runtime, then we have ways to kind of help facilitate that as well. So I don't think that it's a pick one or the other.
If it were like a greenfield project, if it's existing projects which is already using Spring Cloud, then sure, right? For these overlap portions, of course, there are lots of things that Spring Cloud does that doesn't have an overlap with Kubernetes. Right. We're talking about that.
Yep.
Let's say it's a greenfield project, and you have to choose a solution for service discovery. You have to choose a solution for configs, and now. Just two things that came at the top of my head, right?
Yep.
For those two, you can either go with the Spring Cloud solution or go with the Kubernetes solution. Now, considering that this is an application that's already designed to run on Kubernetes, what would be a good use case where you would go, like, don't use the Kubernetes offered solutions, use Spring Cloud instead? Or so, would you, for a native, you know, you would go for the native approach?
Yeah, so I don't know about you, but as just a developer, Kubernetes always kind of scared me. I was like, what is this thing over here? There's some kind of hand waving on and things happen. And now my application's in production, right? So it depends on what your team really understands. Like, do you have an entire team that can help with DevOps and facilitate that push to Kubernetes? Or are you a small development team and don't really understand Kubernetes? What are the types of applications you're building, right? What if I have two services that go into production? Do I really need Kubernetes now? So there are some questions there. I would say it really depends on the kind of skills that the development team has and the types of applications that you're building.
That's fair. And for the record, Kubernetes scares me too. I feel more at home with the Spring Cloud solutions because it's a programming model that I'm used to.
For sure.
And I honestly feel Spring Cloud offers me more control. Just like you said, with Kubernetes, it's like use their way or nothing, right? You don't have that element of control. I feel like for large applications, people would rather have the control.
It depends what your team is doing, what you're trying to build, what you're trying to get into production. And so we haven't really talked about it lately, but Spring falls under VMware Tanzu. VMware Tanzu is kind of the shepherd of the Spring open source product. And we have a lot of other products around building enterprise applications for multi-cloud environments. And a few of those are building Spring applications. So we have a product called TAP, which is Tanzu Application Platform. And that is really about helping bridge that gap between development and DevOps. And just saying, hey, as a developer, I just want to push my code to a Git repo somewhere. But as a DevOps platform engineer, I want to see that entire pipeline to production. Maybe that production is Kubernetes somewhere. How can we bridge that gap? And so we have some products that will definitely help around that.
Speaking of Tanzu and Azure Spring Cloud as well, which came up a lot during SpringOn.
Yep.
Can you talk about why a developer would want to consider that as opposed to just a Kubernetes solution hosted on any of these AWS or Azure or Kubernetes products?
Yeah, I mean, it comes back to what you and I just discussed. Maybe I really don't care about infrastructure. Maybe I don't need the total control over that infrastructure. So we have a really good partnership with Microsoft. We have a product called ASA or Azure Spring Apps. And this is really a fully managed service that helps developers focus on writing code, not infrastructure. underneath the hood, we're using something like TAP in Kubernetes underneath the hood to kind of give you the power of Kubernetes in the cloud and all the things that come with that without having to be, as we said, scared of that whole scenario, right? So I think, you know, similar platforms have given you this, but as a Spring developer, I'm a big fan of ASA and just being able to push my code somewhere, knowing that there's a really good infrastructure in place to kind of run my code, scale my code as I need it.
All right. One last question I'm going to ask you. I'm going to ask you the AI question. Going there. It's late 2023. You have to talk about AI.
Of course.
A common impression that Java developers have had is that they're somehow missing out on AI, right? It seems to be more of like a Python as a language has kind of encroached that area. And a lot of Java developers are either considering learning Python so that they can get into AI, or they think, okay, at some point of time, AI is going to be available to Java developers as well as like as first-class support in terms of libraries and all that. Where does Spring Framework see itself as a, like, just like it integrates with all this other stuff?
Yeah.
Where does Spring Framework see in the integration with AI? I know there's a Spring AI project, which is kind of like just started.
Yep.
Can you talk about, you know, any insights into how Spring team sees AI as a part of their solutions?
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned Spring AI, because we just kind of announced that at Spring One. And yeah, everything is AI these days. If you have a .ai domain name, you could probably get acquired for a lot of money these days. But yeah, I think I'm going to step back and just talk about AI in general, like how I've been looking at it. And I do a lot of videos, and in the videos, I would use something like Copilot or ChatGPT. And I was like, you know, I often get questions like, what is that plugin that's like figuring out exactly what code you need to write? And I said, that's Copilot. And so I think, you know, as a developer, as an educator, I'm really excited about AI because it helps me, you know, it's not always right, but it helps me write code. It helps me write scripts for videos. It does a lot to enable me in my workflow. And I think it just makes me a more productive developer, a more productive creator. So from a personal standpoint, I'm really excited about AI and not all doom and gloom like a lot of people are. I'm actually more excited than doom and gloom. So from that standpoint, that's me. From the Spring side of things, obviously we see that AI is going to be important. But then, you know, where does it fit? You always kind of come up with these questions. You know, I got this on a show yesterday. We talked about Spring Office Hours. We run a live stream every Tuesday that we turn into a podcast. And the main motivation behind that was to get questions. And people were talking about like, well, why isn't this kind of built into the framework? And it's like, you have to draw the line somewhere, right? Like the framework is the core framework. It's pretty massive as it is already. You have to like, some of these things have to be externalized into different projects. And I think AI is a perfect example of that. Like we know as Spring developers, we want to take advantage of AI capabilities in our Spring applications. How do we do it? So it's not built into the framework. It's another, right now it's an experimental project called Spring AI. But really, if you wanted to, you can go out and talk to ChatGPT today through their API in just a normal Spring app on your own. This kind of facilitates that and gives you some abstractions on top of that. So I think, you know, this is just the beginning of that project, but I'm excited by it because now we can kind of work in AI workloads into our different applications. And I think that's how Spring is thinking of it right now. It's anything that is important to developers, to customers of, you know, Spring projects, I think we're listening and we're trying to adapt to that. And I think this is kind of the first sign of that, like, hey, you want to take advantage of AI in your projects, bring in Spring AI, and you can do that effortlessly. So.
All right. Fair enough. Before we wrap up, Dan, can you talk about where someone can find you and your content? I'm going to plug, you know, put the list of your, you know, some of the articles that I really liked that you've written, and your YouTube channel and all that.
Yep.
Just an overview of where people would would be able to follow you.
Yeah, for sure. So I have a personal website at danvega.dev. You can find all my blog articles on there. You can find lists of different social networks, YouTube, Twitter. I'm active on Twitter these days. I enjoy being over there. But yeah, there's there. The Tanzu Developer Center, as you mentioned, is a really great free resource if you want to learn all things Spring, Kubernetes, whatever it is. There's a bunch of guides, workshops, and et cetera over there. And yeah, I think those are the two kind of main places. And then obviously like the YouTube channel. So
cool. And the office hours in the Spring Developer, which I highly, highly recommend. Yeah.
Yes. So Spring Office Hours is you. It's on the Tanzu Developer Center. It's one of the TV shows. But yeah, again, we do that live stream every Tuesday. We are there to keep you up to date with what's happening in the Spring ecosystem, answer your questions. And if you can't catch us live, you can catch us on a podcast. So
cool. Well, Dan, it was an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for taking the time and speaking to me. It was a lot of fun.
Like I said at the beginning, thank you for having me on. I've been a big fan of yours for a long, long time. I can't believe this is the first time we are sitting down talking to each other. And I certainly hope it's not the last. Thank you.
Thank you so much.